This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Andromeda Strain by Michael Crichton, performed by David Morse. Day 1. Contact. 1. The Country of Lost Borders. A man with binoculars. That is how it began. With a man standing by the side of the road, on a crest overlooking a small Arizona town, on a winter night. Lieutenant Roger Shawn must have found the binoculars difficult. The metal would be cold, and he would be clumsy in his fur parka and heavy gloves. His breath, hissing out into the moonlit air, would have fogged the lenses. He would be forced to pause to wipe them frequently, using a stubby, gloved finger. He could not have known the futility of this action. Binoculars were worthless to see into that town and uncover its secrets. He would have been astonished to learn that the men who finally succeeded used instruments a million times more powerful than binoculars. There was something sad, foolish, and human in the image of Shawn leaning against a boulder, propping his arms on it, and holding the binoculars to his eyes. Though cumbersome, the binoculars would at least feel comfortable and familiar in his hands. It would be one of the last familiar sensations before his death. We can imagine and try to reconstruct what happened from that point on. Lieutenant Shawn swept over the town slowly and methodically. He could see it was not large, just a half-dozen wooden buildings set out along a single main street. It was very quiet. No lights, no activity, no sound carried by the gentle wind. He shifted his attention from the town to the surrounding hills. They were low, dusty, and blunted, with scrubby vegetation and an occasional withered yucca tree crusted in snow. Beyond the hills were more hills, and then the flat expanse of the Mojave Desert, trackless and vast. The Indians called it the Country of Lost Borders. Lieutenant Shawn found himself shivering in the wind. It was February, the coldest month, and it was after 10. He walked back up the road toward the Ford Econovan, with a large rotating antenna on top. The motor was idling softly. It was the only sound he could hear. He opened the rear doors and climbed into the back, shutting the doors behind him. He was enveloped in deep red light, a night light, so that he would not be blinded when he stepped outside. In the red light, the banks of instruments and electronic equipment glowed greenly. Private Lewis Crane, the electronics technician, was there, also wearing a parka. He was hunched over a map, making calculations with occasional reference to the instruments before him. Shawn asked Crane if he were certain they had arrived at the place, and Crane confirmed that they had. Both men were tired. They'd driven all day from Vandenberg in search of the latest scoop satellite. Neither knew much about the scoops, except that they were a series of secret capsules intended to analyze the upper atmosphere and then return. Shawn and Crane had the job of finding the capsules once they had landed. In order to facilitate recovery, the satellites were fitted with electronic beepers that began to transmit signals when they came down to an altitude of 5 miles. That was why the van had so much radio directional equipment. In essence, it was performing its own triangulation. In Army parlance, it was known as single-unit triangulation, and it was highly effective, though slow. The procedure was simple enough. The van stopped and fixed its position, recording the strength and direction of the radio beam from the satellite. Once this was done, it would be driven in the most likely direction of the satellite for a distance of 20 miles. Then it would stop and take new coordinates. In this way, a series of triangulation points could be mapped, and the van could proceed to the satellite by a zigzag path, stopping every 20 miles to correct any error. The method was slower than using two vans, but it was safer. The Army felt that two vans in an area might arouse suspicion. For 6 hours, the van had been closing on the Scoop satellite. Now they were almost there. Crane tapped the map with a pencil in a nervous way and announced the name of the town at the foot of the hill. Piedmont, Arizona. Population, 48. Both men laughed over that, though they were both inwardly concerned. The Vandenberg ESA, or estimated site of arrival, had been 12 miles north of Piedmont. Vandenberg computed this site on the basis of radar observations and 1410 computer trajectory projections. The estimates were not usually wrong by more than a few hundred yards. Yet there was no denying the radio directional equipment, which located the satellite beeper directly in the center of town. Sean suggested that someone from the town might have seen it coming down. It would be glowing with the heat, and might have retrieved it, bringing it into Piedmont. This was reasonable, except that a native of Piedmont who happened upon an American satellite fresh from space would have told someone. Reporters, police, NASA, the Army, someone. But they had heard nothing. Sean climbed back down from the van, with Crane scrambling after him, shivering as the cold air struck him. Together, the two men looked out over the town. It was peaceful, but completely dark. Sean noticed that the gas station and the motel both had their lights doused, yet they represented the only gas station and motel for miles. And then Sean noticed the birds. In the light of the full moon, he could see them, big birds, gliding in slow circles over the buildings, passing like black shadows across the face of the moon. He wondered why he hadn't noticed them before, and asked Crane what he made of them. Crane said he didn't make anything of them. As a joke, he added, maybe they're buzzards. Well, that's what they look like, all right, Sean said. Crane laughed nervously, his breath hissing out into the night. But why should there be buzzards here? They only come when something is dead. Sean lit a cigarette, cupping his hands around the lighter, protecting the flame from the wind. He said nothing, but looked down at the buildings, the outline of the little town. Then he scanned the town once more with binoculars, but saw no signs of life or movement. At length, he lowered the binoculars and dropped his cigarette under the crisp snow, where it sputtered and died. He turned to Crane and said, "We'd better go down and have a look." 2. Vandenberg. 300 miles away, in the large, square, windowless room that served as mission control for Project Scoop, Lieutenant Edgar Comro sat with his feet on his desk and a stack of scientific journal articles before him. Comro was serving as control officer for the night. It was a duty he filled once a month, directing the evening operations of the skeleton crew of 12. Tonight, the crew was monitoring the progress and reports of the van coded Caper 1, now making its way across the Arizona desert. Comro disliked this job. The room was gray and lighted with fluorescent lights. The tone was sparsely utilitarian, and Comro found it unpleasant. He never came to Mission Control except during a launch, when the atmosphere was different. Then the room was filled with busy technicians, each at work on a single complex task, each tense with a peculiar cold anticipation that precedes any spacecraft launch. But nights were dull. Nothing ever happened at night. Comro took advantage of the time and used it to catch up on reading. By profession, he was a cardiovascular physiologist, with special interest in stresses induced at high G accelerations. Tonight, Comro was reviewing a journal article titled "Stoichiometrics of Oxygen Carrying Capacity and Diffusion Gradients with Increased Arterial Gas Tensions." He found it slow reading and only moderately interesting. Thus, he was willing to be interrupted when the overhead loudspeaker, which carried the voice transmission from the van of Sean and Crane, clicked on. Sean said, "This is Caper 1 to Vandal Decker. Caper 1 to Vandal Decker. Are you reading? Over?" Comro, feeling amused, replied that he was indeed reading. We're about to enter the town of Piedmont and recover the satellite. Very good, Caper One. Leave your radio open. Roger. This was a regulation of the recovery technique, as outlined in the system's rules manual of Project Scoop. The SRM was a thick, gray paperback that sat at one corner of Comro's desk, where he could refer to it easily. Comro knew that conversation between Van and Bass was taped, and later became part of the permanent project file. But he had never understood any good reason for this. In fact, it had always seemed to him a straightforward proposition. The van went out, got the capsule, and came back. He shrugged and returned to his paper on gas tensions, only half listening to Sean's voice as it said, "We are now inside the town. We've just passed a gas station and a motel. All quiet here. There's no sign of life. The signals from the satellite are stronger. There's a church half a block ahead. There are no lights or activity of any kind." Comro put his journal down. The strained quality of Sean's voice was unmistakable. Normally, Comro would have been amused at the thought of two grown men made jittery by entering a small, sleepy, desert town. But he knew Sean personally, and he knew that Sean, whatever other virtues he might have, utterly lacked an imagination. Sean could fall asleep in a horror movie. He was that kind of man. Comro began to listen. Over the crackling static, he heard the rumbling of the van engine, and he heard the two men in the van talking quietly. Sean. "Pretty quiet around here." Crane. "Yes, sir." There was a pause. Crane. "Sir?" Sean. "Yes?" Crane. "Did you see that?" Sean. "See what?" Crane. "Back there, on the sidewalk? It looked like a body." Sean. "You're imagining things." Another pause, and then Comro heard the van come to a halt, brakes squealing. Sean. "Jesus." Crane. "It's another one, sir." Sean. "Looks dead." Crane. "Shall I?" Sean. "No. Stay in the van." His voice became louder, more formal, as he ran through the call. This is Caper One, to Vandeldecca. Over. Comro picked up the microphone. Reading you. What's happened? Sean, his voice tight, said, "Sir, we see bodies. Lots of them. They appear to be dead." "Are you certain, Caper One?" "For Christ's sake," Sean said. "Of course we're certain." Comro said mildly, "Proceed to the capsule, Caper One." As he did so, he looked around the room. The 12 other men in the skeleton crew were staring at him, their eyes blank, unseeing. They were listening to the transmission. The van rumbled to life again. Comro swung his feet off the desk and punched the red security button on his console. That button automatically isolated the mission control room. No one would be allowed in or out without Comro's permission. Then he picked up the telephone and said, "Get me Major Manchek, M-A-N-C-H-E-K. This is a stat call. I'll hold." Manchek was the chief duty officer for the month, the man directly responsible for all Scoop activities during February. While he waited, he cradled the phone in his shoulder and lit a cigarette. Over the loudspeaker, Sean could be heard to say, "Do they look dead to you, Crane?" Crane. "Yes, sir. Kind of peaceful, but dead." Sean. "Somehow, they don't really look dead. There's something missing, something funny. But they're all over. Must be dozens of them." Crane. "Like they dropped in their tracks. Stumbled and fallen down dead." Sean. "All over the streets, on the sidewalks." Another silence. Then Crane.
Sir?
Sean.
Jesus.
Crane.
You see him? The man in the white robe? Walking across the street?
Sean.
I see him.
Crane.
He's just stepping over them like...
Sean.
He's coming toward us.
Crane.
Sir, look, I think we should get out of here if you don't mind my...
The next sound was a high-pitched scream and a crunching noise. Transmission ended at this point, and Vandenberg's scoop mission control was not able to raise the two men again. 3. Crisis. Gladstone, upon hearing of the death of Chinese Gordon in Egypt, was reported to have muttered irritably that his general might have chosen a more propitious time to die. Gordon's death threw the Gladstone government into turmoil and crisis. An aide suggested that the circumstances were unique and unpredictable, to which Gladstone crossly answered, "All crises are the same." He meant political crises, of course. There were no scientific crises in 1885, and indeed none for nearly 40 years afterward. Since then, there have been 8 of major importance. 2 have received wide publicity. It is interesting that both the publicized crises, atomic energy and space capability, have concerned chemistry and physics, not biology. This is to be expected. Physics was the first of the natural sciences to become fully modern and highly mathematical. Chemistry followed in the wake of physics, but biology, the retarded child, lagged far behind. Even in the time of Newton and Galileo, men knew more about the moon and other heavenly bodies than they did about their own. It was not until the late 1940s that the situation changed. The post-war period ushered in a new era of biologic research, spurred by the discovery of antibiotics. Suddenly, there was both enthusiasm and money for biology, and a torrent of discoveries poured forth. Tranquilizers, steroid hormones, immunochemistry, the genetic code. By 1953, the first kidney was transplanted, and by 1958, the first birth control pills were tested. It was not long before biology was the fastest-growing field in all science. It was doubling its knowledge every 10 years. Far-sighted researchers talked seriously of changing genes, controlling evolution, regulating the mind. Ideas that had been wild speculation 10 years before. And yet, there had never been a biologic crisis. The Andromeda strain provided the first. According to Lewis Bornheim, a crisis is a situation in which a previously tolerable set of circumstances is suddenly, by the addition of another factor, rendered wholly intolerable. Whether the additional factor is political, economic, or scientific hardly matters. The death of a national hero, the instability of prices, or a technological discovery can all set events in motion. In this sense, Gladstone was right. All crises are the same. The noted scholar, Alfred Pockran, in his study of crises, culture, crisis, and change, has made several interesting points. First, he observes that every crisis has its beginnings long before the actual onset. Thus, Einstein published his theories of relativity in 1905 through 15, 40 years before his work culminated in the end of a war. The start of an age, and the beginnings of a crisis. Similarly, in the early 20th century, American, German, and Russian scientists were all interested in space travel, but only the Germans recognized the military potential of rockets. And after the war, when the German rocket installation at Peenemünde was cannibalized by the Soviets and Americans, it was only the Russians who made immediate vigorous moves toward developing space capabilities. The Americans were content to tinker playfully with rockets. And 10 years later, this resulted in an American scientific crisis involving Sputnik, American Education, the ICBM, and the Missile Gap. Pockran also observes that a crisis is compounded of individuals and personalities which are unique. It is as difficult to imagine Alexander at the Rubicon and Eisenhower at Waterloo as it is difficult to imagine Darwin writing to Roosevelt about the potential for an atomic bomb. A crisis is made by men who enter into the crisis with their own prejudices, propensities, and predispositions. A crisis is the sum of intuition and blind spots, a blend of facts noted and facts ignored. Yet underlying the uniqueness of each crisis is a disturbing sameness. A characteristic of all crises is their predictability, in retrospect. They seem to have a certain inevitability. They seem predestined. This is not true of all crises, but it is true of sufficiently many to make the most hardened historian cynical and misanthropic. In the light of Pockran's arguments, it is interesting to consider the background and personalities involved in the Andromeda strain. At the time of Andromeda, there had never been a crisis of biological science, and the first Americans faced with the facts were not disposed to think in terms of one. Sean and Crane were capable, but not thoughtful men, and Edgar Comroe, the night officer at Vandenberg, though a scientist, was not prepared to consider anything beyond the immediate irritation of a quiet evening ruined by an inexplicable problem. According to protocol, Comroe called his superior officer, Major Arthur Manchek, and here the story takes a different turn. For Manchek was both prepared and disposed to consider a crisis of the most major proportions. But he was not prepared to acknowledge it. Major Manchek, his face still creased with sleep, sat on the edge of Comroe's desk and listened to the replay of the tape from the van. When it was finished, he said, "Strangest damn thing I ever heard," and played it over again. While he did so, he carefully filled his pipe with tobacco, lit it, and tamped it down. Arthur Manchek was an engineer, a quiet, heavy-set man plagued by labile hypertension, which threatened to end further promotions as an army officer. He had been advised on many occasions to lose weight, but had been unable to do so. He was therefore considering abandoning the army for a career as a scientist in private industry, where people did not care what your weight or blood pressure was. Manchek had come to Vandenberg from Wright-Patterson in Ohio, where he had been in charge of experiments in spacecraft landing methods. His job had been to develop a capsule shape that could touch down with equal safety on either land or sea. Manchek had succeeded in developing three new shapes that were promising. His success led to a promotion and transfer to Vandenberg. Here, he did administrative work, and hated it. People bored Manchek. The mechanics of manipulation and the vagaries of subordinate personality held no fascination for him. He often wished he were back at the wind tunnels of Wright-Patterson, particularly on nights when he was called out of bed by some damn fool problem. Tonight, he felt irritable and under stress. His reaction to this was characteristic. He became slow. He moved slowly. He thought slowly. He proceeded with a dull and plodding deliberation. It was the secret of his success. Whenever people around him became excited, Manchek seemed to grow more disinterested, until he appeared about to fall asleep. It was a trick he had for remaining totally objective and clear-headed. Now he sighed and puffed on his pipe as the tape spun out for the second time. "No communications breakdown, I take it." Comroe shook his head. "We checked all systems at this end. We are still monitoring the frequency." He turned on the radio, and hissing static filled the room. "You know about the audio screen?" "Vaguely," Manchek said, suppressing a yawn. In fact, the audio screen was a system he had developed 3 years before. In simplest terms, it was a computerized way to find a needle in a haystack, a machine program that listened to apparently garbled, random sound and picked out certain irregularities. For example, the hubbub of conversation at an embassy cocktail party could be recorded and fed through the computer, which would pick out a single voice and separate it from the rest. It had several intelligence applications.
Well, Comro said, after the transmission ended, we got nothing but the static you hear now. We put it through the audio screen to see if the computer could pick up a pattern, and we ran it through the oscilloscope in the corner.
Across the room, the green face of the scope displayed a jagged, dancing white line, the summated sound of static.
Then, Comro said, we cut in the computer, like so.
He punched a button on his desk console. The oscilloscope line changed character abruptly. It suddenly became quieter, more regular, with a pattern of beating, thumping impulses.
I see, Manchek said.
He had, in fact, already identified the pattern and assessed its meaning. His mind was drifting elsewhere, considering other possibilities, wider ramifications.
Here's the audio, Comro said.
He pressed another button, and the audio version of the signal filled the room. It was a steady, mechanical grinding with a repetitive metallic click. Manchek nodded.
An engine. With a knock.
Yes, sir. We believe the van radio is still broadcasting, and that the engine is still running. That's what we're hearing now, with the static screened away.
All right, Manchek said.
His pipe went out. He sucked on it for a moment, then lit it again, removed it from his mouth, and plucked a bit of tobacco from his tongue.
Oh, we need evidence, he said,
almost to himself. He was considering categories of evidence and possible findings, contingencies.
Evidence of what?
Comro said. Manchek ignored the question.
Have we got a scavenger on the base?
I'm not sure, sir. If we don't, we can get one from Edwards.
Then do it, Manchek stood up.
He had made his decision, and now he felt tired again. An evening of telephone calls faced him, an evening of irritable operators and bad connections and puzzled voices at the other end.
We'll want to fly by over that town, he said, and a complete scan. All canisters to come directly. Alert the labs.
He also ordered Comro to bring in the technicians, especially Jaegers. Manchek disliked Jaegers, who was effete and precious. But Manchek also knew that Jaegers was good, and tonight he needed a good man. At 11:07 p.m., Samuel Gunnar Wilson was moving at 645 miles per hour over the Mojave Desert. Up ahead in the moonlight, he saw the twin lead jets, their afterburners glowing angrily in the night sky. The planes had a heavy, pregnant look. Phosphorus bombs were slung beneath the wings and belly. Wilson's plane was different, sleek and long and black. It was a scavenger, one of seven in the world. The scavenger was the operational version of the X-18. It was an intermediate-range reconnaissance jet aircraft, fully equipped for day or night intelligence flights. It was fitted with two side-slung 16-millimeter cameras, one for the visible spectrum and one for low-frequency radiation. In addition, it had a center-mount Homans infrared multi-specs camera, as well as the usual electronic and radio detection gear. All films and plates were, of course, processed automatically in the air, and were ready for viewing as soon as the aircraft returned to base. All this technology made the scavenger almost impossibly sensitive. It could map the outlines of a city in blackout,
and could follow the movements of individual trucks and cars at 8,000 feet. It could detect a submarine to a depth of 200 feet. It could locate harbor mines by wave motion deformities, and it could obtain a precise photograph of a factory from the residual heat of the building 4 hours after it had shut down. So the scavenger was the ideal instrument to fly over Piedmont, Arizona, in the dead of night. Wilson carefully checked his equipment, his hands fluttering over the controls, touching each button and lever, watching the blinking green lights that indicated that all systems were in order. His earphones crackled. The lead plane said lazily, "Coming up on the town, Gunner. You see it?" He leaned forward in the cramped cockpit. He was low, only 500 feet above the ground, and for a moment he could see nothing but a blur of sand, snow, and yucca trees. Then, up ahead, buildings in the moonlight. "Roger, I see it." "Okay, Gunner, give us room." He dropped back, putting half a mile between himself and the other two planes. They were going into the P-square formation for direct visualization of target by phosphorus flare. Direct visualization was not really necessary. Scavenger could function without it. But Vandenberg seemed insistent that they gather all possible information about the town. The lead plane spread, moving wide until they were parallel to the main street of the town. "Gunner, ready to roll?" Wilson placed his fingers delicately over the camera buttons, four fingers, as if playing the piano. "Ready. We're going in now." The two planes swooped low, dipping gracefully toward the town. They were now very wide and seemingly inches above the ground as they began to release the bombs. As each struck the ground, a blazing white-hot sphere went up, bathing the town in an unearthly, glaring light and reflecting off the metal underbellies of the planes. The jets climbed, their run finished. But Gunner did not see them. His entire attention, his mind and his body, was focused on the town. "All yours, Gunner." Wilson did not answer. He dropped his nose, cracked down his flaps, and felt a shudder as the plane sank sickeningly like a stone toward the ground. Below him, the area around the town was lighted for hundreds of yards in every direction. He pressed the camera buttons and felt, rather than heard, the vibrating whir of the cameras. For a long moment, he continued to fall, and then he shoved the stick forward, and the plane seemed to catch in the air to grab and lift and climb. He had a fleeting glimpse of the main street. He saw bodies, bodies, everywhere, spread-eagled, lying in the streets, across cars. "Jesus," he said. And then he was up, still climbing, bringing the plane around in a slow arc, preparing for the descent into his second run, and trying not to think of what he had seen. One of the first rules of air reconnaissance was, ignore the scenery. Analysis and evaluation were not the job of the pilot. That was left to the experts, and pilots who forgot this, who became too interested in what they were photographing, got into trouble. Usually, they crashed. As the plane came down into a flat second run, he tried not to look at the ground. But he did, and again saw the bodies. The phosphorus flares were burning low, the lighting was darker, more sinister and subdued, but the bodies were still there. He had not been imagining it. "Jesus," he said again. "Sweet Jesus." The sign on the door said Data Prosex Epsilon, and underneath in red lettering, admission by clearance card only. Inside was a comfortable sort of briefing room, screen on one wall, a dozen steel tubing and leather chairs facing it, and a projector in the back. When Manchek and Comro entered the room, Jaegers was already waiting for them, standing at the front of the room by the screen. Jaegers was a short man with a springy step and an eager, rather hopeful face. Though not well-liked on the base, he was nonetheless the acknowledged master of reconnaissance interpretation. He had the sort of mind that delighted in small and puzzling details, and was well-suited to his job. Jaggers rubbed his hands as Manchek and Comro sat down.
"Well, then," he said, "might as well get right to it. I think we have something to interest you tonight."
He nodded to the projectionist in the back.
"First picture?"
The room lights darkened. There was a mechanical click, and the screen lighted to show an aerial view of a small desert town.
"This is an unusual shot,"
Jaggers said.
"From our files, taken 2 months ago from Janos 12, our recon satellite, orbiting at an altitude of 187 miles, as you know. The technical quality here is quite good. Can't read the license plates on the cars yet, but we're working on it, perhaps by next year."
Manchek shifted in his chair, but said nothing.
"You can see the town here,"
Jaggers said.
"Piedmont, Arizona. Population, 48, and not much to look at. Even from 187 miles, here's the general store, the gas station. Notice how clearly you can read Gulf, and the post office, the motel. Everything else you see is private residences. Church, over here. Well, next picture."
Another click. This was dark, with a reddish tint, and was clearly an overview of the town in white and dark red. The outlines of the buildings were very dark.
"We begin here with the scavenger IR plates. These are infrared films, as you know, which produce a picture on the basis of heat instead of light. Anything warm appears white on the picture. Anything cold is black. Now then, you can see here that the buildings are dark. They are colder than the ground. As night comes on, the buildings give up their heat more rapidly."
What are those white spots?"
Comro said. There were 40 or 50 white areas on the film.
"Those,"
Jaggers said,
"are bodies. Some inside houses, some in the street. By count, they number 50. In the case of some of them, such as this one here, you can make out the forelimbs and head clearly. This body is lying flat in the street."
He lit a cigarette and pointed to a white rectangle.
"As nearly as we can tell, this is an automobile, since it's got a bright white spot at one end. This means the motor is still running, still generating heat."
"The van?" Comro said.
Manchek nodded.
"The question now arises,"
Jaggers said,
"are all these people dead? We cannot be certain about that. The bodies appear to be of different temperatures. 47 are rather cold, indicating death some time ago. 3 are warmer. 2 of those are in this car here."
"Our men," Comro said. "And the third?"
"The third is rather puzzling. You see him here, apparently standing or lying curled in the street. Observe that he's quite white and therefore quite warm. Our temperature scans indicate that he's about 95 degrees, which is a little on the cool side, but probably attributable to peripheral vasoconstriction in the night desert air. Drops his skin temperature. Next slide."
The third film flicked onto the screen. Manchek frowned at the spot. "It's moved."
"Exactly. This film was made on the second passage. The spot has moved approximately 20 yards. Next picture."
A third film. "Moved again."
"Yes, an additional 5 or 10 yards.
"So, one person down there is alive?"
"That," Jaggers said, "is the presumptive conclusion."
Manchek cleared his throat.
"Does that mean it's what you think?"
"Yes, sir. It's what we think."
"There's a man down there, walking among the corpses."
Jaggers shrugged and tapped the screen.
"It is difficult to account for the data in any other manner, and..."
At that moment,
A private entered the room with three circular metal canisters under his arm.
Sir, we have films of the direct visualization by P-Square.
Run them, Manchek said. The film was threaded into a projector. A moment later, Lieutenant Wilson was ushered into the room. Jaeger said,
I haven't reviewed these films yet. Perhaps the pilot should narrate?
Manchek nodded and looked at Wilson, who got up and walked to the front of the room, wiping his hands nervously on his pants. He stood alongside the screen and faced his audience, beginning in a flat monotone.
Sir, my flybys were made between 11:08 and 11:13 p.m. this evening. There were two, a start from the east and a return from the west, done at an average speed of 214 miles per hour, at a median altitude by corrected altimeter of 800 feet, and an...
Just a minute, son, Manchek said, raising his hand.
This isn't a grilling. Just tell it naturally.
Wilson nodded and swallowed. The room lights went down and the projector whirred to life. The screen showed the town bathed in glaring white light as the plane came down over it.
This is my first pass, Wilson said. East to west at 11:08. We're looking from the left-wing camera, which is running at 96 frames per second. As you can see, my altitude is falling rapidly. Straight ahead is the main street of the target.
He stopped. The bodies were clearly visible, and the van stopped in the street, its rooftop antenna still turning slow revolutions. As the plane continued its run, approaching the van, they could see the driver collapsed over the steering wheel.
Excellent definition, Jaeger said. That fine-grained film really gives resolution when you need...
Wilson, Manchek said, was telling us about his run.
Yes, sir, Wilson said, clearing his throat.
He stared at the screen.
At this time, I'm right over the target where I observed the casualties. You see here, my estimate at that time was 75, sir.
His voice was quiet and tense. There was a break in the film, some numbers, and the image came on again.
Now I'm coming back for my second run, Wilson said. The flares are already burning low, but you can see...
Stop the film, Manchek said.
The projectionist froze the film at a single frame. It showed the long, straight main street of the town and the bodies.
Go back.
The film was run backward, the jet seeming to pull away from the street.
There. Stop it now.
The frame was frozen. Manchek got up and walked close to the screen, peering off to one side.
Look at this, he said, pointing to a figure.
It was a man in knee-length white robes, standing and looking up at the plane. He was an old man, with a withered face. His eyes were wide.
What do you make of this? Manchek said to Jaegers.
Jaegers moved close. He frowned.
You're running forward a bit.
The film advanced. They could clearly see the man turn his head, roll his eyes, following the plane as it passed over him.
And now backward,
Jaeger said. The film was run back. Jaeger smiled bleakly.
The man looks alive to me, sir.
Yes, Manchek said crisply. He certainly does.
And with that, he walked out of the room. As he left, he paused and announced that he was declaring a state of emergency, that everyone on the base was confined to quarters until further notice, that there would be no outside calls or communication, and that what they had seen in this room was confidential. Outside in the hallway, he headed for mission control. Comro followed him.
I want you to call General Wheeler, Manchek said. Tell him I've declared an SOE without proper authorization, and ask him to come down immediately.
Technically, no one but the commander had the right to declare a state of emergency. Comro said,
Wouldn't you rather tell him yourself?
I've got other things to do, Manchek said.
4. Alert. When Arthur Manchek stepped into the small soundproofed booth and sat down before the telephone, he knew exactly what he was going to do. But he was not very sure why he was doing it. As one of the senior SCOOP officers, he had received a briefing nearly a year before on Project Wildfire. It had been given, Manchek remembered, by a short little man with a dry, precise way of speaking. He was a university professor, and he had outlined the project. Manchek had forgotten the details, except that there was a laboratory somewhere and a team of 5 scientists who could be alerted to man the laboratory. The function of the team was investigation of possible extraterrestrial life forms introduced on American spacecraft returning to Earth. Manchek had not been told who the 5 men were. He knew only that a special Defense Department trunk line existed for calling them out. In order to hook into the line, one had only to dial the binary of some number. He reached into his pocket and withdrew his wallet, then fumbled for a moment until he found the card he had been given by the professor. In case of fire, notify Division 87. Emergencies only. He stared at the card and wondered what exactly would happen if he dialed the binary of 87. He tried to imagine the sequence of events. Who would he talk to? Would someone call him back? Would there be an inquiry, a referral to higher authority? He rubbed his eyes and stared at the card, and finally he shrugged. One way or the other, he would find out. He tore a sheet of paper from the pad in front of him, next to the telephone, and wrote 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1st, 2 to the 2nd, 2 to the 3rd, 2 to the 4th, 2 to the 5th, 2 to the 6th, 2 to the 7th. This was the basis of the binary system. Base 2 raised to some power. 2 to the 0 power was 1, 2 to the 1st was 2, 2 squared was 4, and so on. Manchek quickly wrote another line beneath. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. Then he began to add up the numbers to get a total of 87. He circled these numbers. 1, 2, 4, 16, 64. And then he drew in the binary code. Binary numbers were designed for computers, which utilize an on-off, yes-no kind of language. A mathematician once joked that binary numbers were the way people who have only 2 fingers count. In essence, binary numbers translated normal numbers, which require 10 digits and decimal places, to a system that depended on only 2 digits, 1 and 0. Manchek looked at the number he had just written and inserted the dashes 1-110-1010. A perfectly reasonable telephone number. Manchek picked up the telephone and dialed. The time was exactly 12 midnight. Day 2. Piedmont. 5. The early hours. The machinery was there. The cables, the codes, the teleprinters, it had all been waiting dormant for 2 years. It only required Manchek's call to set the machinery in motion. When he finished dialing, he heard a series of mechanical clicks, and then a low hum, which meant, he knew, that the call was being fed into one of the scrambled trunk lines. After a moment, the humming stopped, and a voice said, "This is a recording. State your name and your message, and hang up."
"Major Arthur Manchek, Vandenberg Air Force Base, SCOOP Mission Control. I believe it is necessary to call up a wildfire alert. I have confirmatory visual data at this post, which has just been closed for security reasons." As he spoke, it occurred to him that it was all rather improbable. Even the tape recorder would disbelieve him. He continued to hold the telephone in his hand, somehow expecting an answer. But there was none.
Only a click as the connection was automatically broken. The line was dead. He hung up and sighed. It was all very unsatisfying. Manchek expected to be called back within a few minutes by Washington. He expected to receive many calls in the next few hours, and so remained at the phone. Yet he received no calls, for he did not know that the process he had initiated was automatic. Once mobilized, the wildfire alert would proceed ahead and not be recalled for at least 12 hours. Within 10 minutes of Manchek's call, the following message clattered across the scrambled maximum security cabler units of the nation. Unit, top secret. Code follows as CBW99234-435-6778-90. Pug coordinates Delta 8997. Message follows as wildfire alert has been called. Repeat, wildfire alert has been called. Coordinates to read NASA, AMC, NSC, COM, DEC. Time of command to read LL-59-07 on date. Further notations as press blackface, potential directive 7-L2, alert status until further notice, end message. Disengage. This was an automatic cable. Everything about it, including the announcement of a press blackout and a possible directive 712, was automatic and followed for Manchek's call. 5 minutes later, there was a second cable which named the man on the wildfire team. Unit, top secret. Code follows as CBW99234-435-6778-900. Message follows as the following male American citizens are being placed on Zed Kappa status. Previous top secret clearance has been confirmed. The names are Stone, Jeremy, 81, Levitt, Peter, 04, Burton, Charles, L51, Christensen, cancel this line, cancel, to read as Kirk, Christian, 142, Hall, Mark, L77. Accord these men Zed Kappa status until further notice. End message. End message. In theory, this cable was also quite routine. Its purpose was to name the 5 members who were being given Zed Kappa status, the code for OK status. Unfortunately, however, the machine misprinted one of the names and failed to reread the entire message. Normally, when one of the printout units of a secret trunk line miswrote part of a message, the entire message was rewritten, or else it was reread by the computer to certify its corrected form. The message was thus open to doubt. In Washington and elsewhere, a computer expert was called in to confirm the accuracy of the message by what is called reverse tracing. The Washington expert expressed grave concern about the validity of the message since the machine was printing out other minor mistakes such as capital L when it meant lowercase l. The upshot of all this was that the first 2 names on the list were accorded status, while the rest were not, pending confirmation. Allison Stone was tired. At her home in the hills overlooking the Stanford campus, she and her husband, the chairman of the Stanford Bacteriology Department, had held a party for 15 couples, and everyone had stayed late. Mrs. Stone was annoyed. She had been raised in official Washington, where 1 second cup of coffee, offered pointedly without cognac, was accepted as a signal to go home. Unfortunately, she thought academics did not follow the rules. She had served the second cup of coffee hours ago, and everybody was still there. Shortly before 1 a.m., the doorbell rang. Answering it, she was surprised to see 2 military men standing side by side in the night. They seemed awkward and nervous to her, and she assumed they were lost.
People often got lost driving through these residential areas at night.
May I help you?
I'm sorry to disturb you, ma'am, one said politely.
But is this the residence of Dr. Jeremy Stone?
Yes, she said, frowning slightly.
It is.
She looked beyond the two men, to the driveway. A blue military sedan was parked there. Another man was standing by the car. He seemed to be holding something in his hand.
Does that man have a gun? She said.
Ma'am, the man said, we must see Dr. Stone at once, please. It all seemed strange to her, and she found herself frightened. She looked across the lawn and saw a fourth man moving up to the house, looking into the window. And the pale light streaming out onto the lawn, she could distinctly see the rifle in his hands. What's going on?
Ma'am, we don't want to disturb your party. Please call Dr. Stone to the door.
Well, I don't know if. Otherwise, we will have to go get him, the man said. She hesitated a moment, then said,
wait here.
She stepped back and started to close the door, but one man had already slipped into the hall. He stood near the door, erect and very polite, with his hat in his hand.
I'll just wait here, ma'am, he said, and smiled at her.
She walked back to the party, trying to show nothing to the guests. Everyone was still talking and laughing. The room was noisy and dense with smoke. She found Jeremy in a corner, in the midst of some argument about riots. She touched his shoulder, and he disengaged himself from the group.
I know this sounds funny, she said, but there is some kind of army man in the hall, and another outside, and two others with guns out on the lawn. They say they want to see you.
For a moment, Stone looked surprised, and then he nodded.
I'll take care of it, he said.
His attitude annoyed her. He seemed almost to be expecting it.
Well, if you knew about this, you might have told.
I didn't, he said. I'll explain later. He walked out to the hallway, where the officer was still waiting. She followed her husband. Stone said,
I am Dr. Stone.
Captain Morton, the man said. He did not offer to shake hands. There's a fire, sir.
All right,
Stone said. He looked down at his dinner jacket.
Do I have time to change?
I'm afraid not, sir. To her astonishment, Allison saw her husband nod quietly.
All right.
He turned to her and said,
I've got to leave.
His face was blank and expressionless, and it seemed to her like a nightmare, his face like that, while he spoke. She was confused and afraid.
When will you be back?
I'm not sure.
A week or two? Maybe longer?
She tried to keep her voice low, but she couldn't help it. She was upset.
What is it?
She said.
Are you under arrest?
No, he said with a slight smile.
It's nothing like that. Make my apologies to everyone, will you?
But the guns,
Mrs. Stone, the military man said. It's our job to protect your husband. From now on, nothing must be allowed to happen to him.
That's right, Stone said. You see, I'm suddenly an important person.
He smiled again, an odd, crooked smile, and gave her a kiss. And then almost before she knew what was happening, he was walking out the door with Captain Morton on one side of him and the other man on the other. The man with the rifle wordlessly fell into place behind them. The man by the car saluted and opened the door. Then the car lights came on, and the doors slammed shut, and the car backed down the drive and drove off into the night. She was still standing by the door when one of her guests came up behind her and said,
Allison, are you all right?
And she turned and found she was able to smile and say,
yes, it's nothing.
Jeremy had to leave. The lab called him. Another one of his late-night experiments going wrong. The guest nodded and said,
shame. That's a delightful party.
In the car, Stone sat back and stared at the men. He recalled that their faces were blank and expressionless. He said,
what have you got for me?
Got, sir?
Yes, damn it. What did they give you for me? They must have given you something.
Oh, yes, sir.
He was handed a slim file. Stenciled on the brown cardboard cover was Project Summary, Scoop. Nothing else?